Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer, and we thank you for joining us. No, I'm not. I'm Gabriel Marcotti. And this is a very special podcast. You probably may have noticed that we're coming to you a day later. That's partly because it's International Week, partly because Natalie Sawyer isn't here, and partly because today I'm joined by an old friend. And if you're a longtime listener and reader of The Times, an old friend of yours as well. He's been a key figure from Game Podcasts in the past, and he's now the chief soccer correspondent for the New York Times. Please welcome back Rory K. Smith. Today, Rory and I are going to discuss four of the bigger talking points in football at the moment, including VAR, the European Super League, other bits and bobs. We all have a tendency to talk too much because we both love the sounds of our own voices, so our producer, Charlie, will cut us off probably at about 10 minutes or so into each talking point. But before we get into that, there was an international break. England scored 10 goals over two games against the Czech Republic and Montenegro. It seems like this Gareth Southgate halo effect keeps going. They're fun to watch. It's exciting. But it was also certainly the game in Montenegro had another big talking point, which was the racist abuse. Right, I want to ask you because, and you guys should go back and if you can find it, behind the New York Times paywall.
Metered paywall.
The metered paywall. Please do read it. You sat down with Raheem Sterling, who there's obviously a lot more to unpack with Raheem Sterling and the treatment he's received from parts of the media and whatnot. We've seen this ugliness happen before with the racism and stuff like that. And it's always followed by this sort of knee-jerk reaction that, well, but oh, fines aren't enough. They're all ludicrous. I mean, UEFA today is exploring it. Mm-hmm. They may get a stadium ban. Is that the best solution for the time being until we can have like facial recognition like in Russia and drones to go and take out miscreants? Or
I think the problem is that, and it's interesting that Gareth Southgate talks about education. Raheem certainly, when I spoke to him, was of the view that you can't just punish people and expect them to immediately change their minds, that that's not really how it works, that there's an element of kind of social education that has to go on. I think in the short term, if UEFA are serious, and we both, I think, like Alexander Seferin, the president of UEFA, I generally think that he's a good thing. He's not flawless, but I'm broadly pro Seferin than anti. If he's serious about wanting to do anything about this, there do have to be draconian punishments. You have to at least illustrate to the national FAs, as much as anything else, that, look, if you can't stop this happening on your territory, you are essentially making it's a hostile environment for people based on the colour of their skin because you can't control your own fans, so you have to be punished seriously, whether that's with games behind closed doors or points deductions, or to be honest, for serial offenders, just throwing them out. Just say, look, if this happens in, I don't know, 3-5 games in a row, you do not get to take part in this qualifying process. This is not how this sport is run. UEFA have to be serious. But at the same time, I think it's really important to remember that people don't become racists when they enter football stadiums. If you are guilty of racist thoughts and you go to a football stadium, that is the kind of demographic that is going to racially abuse players. So it's not that football has a racism problem, that the only people who like football are racists and all racists do is go to football matches. There's a much broader issue at stake, especially in Eastern Europe. And what's most depressing about this incident in Podgorica is that it was really predictable because Danny Rose and Raheem Sterling were both abused playing in Serbia. You see it all the time in that part, not necessarily not just in Montenegro, but in that part of the world, in Eastern Europe, it's far more prevalent.
I'm all for the tackling the social element and stuff like that, and Southgate spoke of education. All that's fine, but I think back to the words of Damaris Smith, who's the former or maybe current, but he worked for the NFL Players Association at some point. And he's like, I'm sure that in 20 years, 50 years, 100 years, through intermarriage and progress and social education, you know, maybe racism will be eradicated. But I'm not going to be around in 100 years. I don't want to deal with it now.
Yeah.
And so actually, I'm in favor of repression. I don't care why they racially abuse people, whether because they say, well, it's just a wind-up to get in their heads, or I don't know.
I don't buy that either.
You know what? But it may be true for some people. I don't know. It doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is that people have a right to go to their place of work and not be racially abused. I think stadium bans are the best solution. I think they've proven to be effective. And obviously, no, they haven't eradicated racism or racist abuse, but we've seen serious problems. My difficulty with points deductions is, okay, so you deduct points. All of a sudden, they're at -7. Then what? Who cares? They're not qualifying anyway. Not to mention, it also gives more power to these people. Stadium ban hurts the FA, and then there's only so much an FA can do, even in the Premier League, in the most high-tech stadiums in the world with their facial recognition and their spotters and blah, 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 and all this jazz. As we both well know, it can still happen. But it hands over, it's really difficult for FAs especially to police it when it's not even their stadiums. You want to incentivize them to do it. A stadium ban certainly does that because they have to play behind closed doors, which hurts their team, and they take a financial hit. Not kicking them out of the competition, I don't think that solves the problem. Ideally, we would punish the individuals, and that's sometimes difficult to do, but it has to have consequences now, and I'm in favor of repression.
Well, and you're quite right that the players who are suffering from it won't see the benefits of an educational process that, to be honest, that you presume has been going on for quite a long time already. That, you know, gradually as a society we're becoming more kind of conscious of these issues and moving away from old racial stereotypes that we had in certainly in Britain and in Western Europe. They're becoming much more outdated. In Eastern Europe, perhaps that's a slower process, but Raheem Sterling and Danny Rose aren't going to benefit if no one in Montenegro is racist in 50 years' time. So from that point of view, yeah, you should. There has to be punishment because just waiting for it to go away isn't going to work. I think what Southgate said is right, that you have to try and do both. By the same token, as you say, like what's the Montenegrin FA going to do
exactly
to tackle social issues in Montenegro? It isn't their job.
We're going to move on now to our first proper topic. Manchester United. A lot of people are taking for granted that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is set to be appointed full-time as Manchester United manager. I'm curious about this, not so much about Solskjaer's merits versus somebody else, because obviously when you bring that up, you're going to go, oh, who else are you going to get? You know, and we know if they go for Pochettino or whatever, it's going to be expensive. But I'm interested in the idea that back in December, they mapped out a path and, you know, they were going to bring this guy in on an interim basis, make a decision in the summer, go after the best possible people. They didn't rule him out. They were possibly going to bring in a director of football. That was widely reported as well. It seems like he comes in, he wins a bunch of games, and they're like, "Yeah, we don't need this blueprint anymore. Everybody seems to like this guy. We're winning games. Let's go for it."
Yeah, that's exactly what's happened. They had an idea in their head that predated the sacking of Mourinho, that they needed a more modern structure. And I don't know, people get really bored and assume you're being kind of too clever and overly modern, and well, it didn't, you know, Brian Clough didn't need a director of football, although ironically he kind of had one, because that's what Peter Taylor did. And they kind of assume that it's just kind of trendiness making you say, oh, you should have a director of football like Atletico Madrid and, I don't know, Boca Juniors and all these hipster clubs. So they had this idea that they wanted a director of football, and I think that it makes sense because all of United's problems since Fergie retired have basically been related to the fact that there is a disconnect between what the board will do and what the board wants and what the manager of the time
wants. Can you
wants.
Explode another myth while you're here?
Mm-hmm, I can try.
You talk about board, right?
Mm.
And this happens all the time. It happens at Chelsea too. Well, if the board want to keep... there is no board.
It's Ed Woodward, Richard Arnold.
Ed Woodward, Richard Arnold, and a couple Glazers occasionally weighing in, right?
Yeah.
So there is no board. Right?
No, it's not. Yeah, they're not having big meetings around an oak table.
It's a hierarchical structure. Yeah. There's no Senate. Okay, this is one of the things that really bugs me, that we still speak of the board when, you know, there is no board. Abramovich doesn't have a board.
It's one of those slightly dishonest football shorthands, which mean you don't have to name an individual. So Ed Woodward decided correctly that they needed a director of football because they've recruited... it's not that they've recruited badly, is it? They've just kind of recruited haphazardly. So they've signed some good players, but not really with a system in mind. Everything changes when they sack a manager.
Short term, too.
But there's a few players that they've signed who've done quite well, and I never quite bought this. And one of the, I mean, the greatest trick that Jose Mourinho pulled was convincing people that Man United had this awful squad. And you saw fans saying, oh, yeah, well, look, you know, he can't be expected to compete with this team, the second most expensive ever established. But it was this incredible kind of cognitive dissonance where you looked at them and thought, no, do you know, these are all really good players, with one or two who are less good players. But you kind of bought into it because Mourinho kept telling you how bad they were. But anyway, so they had this plan for a director of football. I think what they did, bringing Solskjaer in the interim and then saying, look, we're going to look for a director of football, we're going to look for a permanent manager, that was probably the first really good decision Man United have made in terms of how they're run as a club for quite a long time. And then, yeah, they've won. He's won 14 in 19, got them to the quarterfinals of the Champions League.
So why does that all go out the window? A cynic in me would say, okay, I'm Ed Woodward. You know what? Going after a big name, proven manager is going to be such a pain in the butt. I got to go deal with Levy or whoever. It's tricky. It's unpleasant. Everybody, the Glazers are very concerned with their customers, right? The United fan base. They all love Solskjaer. The players love Solskjaer. He's cheap as chips. As long as I can keep his friend Jim away from the club and the transfer activity, and yes, I'm referring to you, Jim Solbakken. Go do some Googling about that guy. I'm all right. I don't need to worry about it. The Glazers will be happy because we're saving money and we got a popular guy and there's a nice bounce.
Yeah.
And let me do that. Let me go with a popular consensus decision.
But they're two separate issues. So the manager thing, Solskjaer has taken them by surprise. I don't think United would even... I think publicly they'd probably admit they weren't expecting him to be this good.
No, but now that it's there...
So now that it's there, there is...
I can ditch the plan to have a proper manager.
No, so hang on. I rescind my no, and insert a yes. So they are right to think, look, he's got this incredible record. He's made everyone feel great. There are still question marks about kind of what, how he compares at the very top level to people like Guardiola. You don't, I mean, even the most ardent United fan would be stretching it to sort of say, well, look, what Solskjaer's done since December means he is up there with Pep Guardiola, winner of the Champions League in 2011. It's quite a long time ago, in 2009. But nevertheless, making that appointment is the logical thing to do because he's in place, the players like him, he's doing well. There is no reason not to give him that job because Pochettino would cost a lot of money. Who is the other candidate we keep talking about? Pochettino would cost a lot of money, and you effectively have to start again with a whole blank slate. Whereas with Solskjaer, he's kind of had these, what, 7-8 months to build up to it. So I think what they're doing with the manager situation is perfectly right. The fault that they're making is tying that in with the fact they need a director of football. And the impression you get is that Solskjaer's success has not only guaranteed him the United manager's job, which it absolutely should do, but it's made them think, do you know what? Maybe there was nothing wrong with the structure all along. Maybe the structure is inside our hearts.
But we don't know that. They could be secretly pursuing directors of football,
well,
and it's just that...
Gap. They met with a headhunting firm twice before Christmas to discuss Nolan Partners, who do a lot of appointments for not
this
just...
This is Kevin Nolan's gaff, right?
This is Kevin Nolan and Ian Nolan, the former Sheffield Wednesday fullback, who've just set up a head... No, it's not them. They met with Nolan Partners, who've done a lot of kind of marketing jobs and financial jobs, but also increasingly are doing football-related jobs. So they placed Dan Ashworth at Brighton, for example.
Should bring A.D. Boothroyd with them.
No snickering. There's nothing. A.D. Boothroyd is a nice man. Anyway, United were quite kind of, by all accounts, kept their cards quite close to their chest on that. But the impression was that they did not quite know what they wanted that position to be. So when you have a director of football, it could be like a statesman-like figure, a kind of ambassadorial role, effectively. It could be like a hard-nosed negotiator guy, or it could be something a bit more holistic, someone who ties everything together and oversees the academy, blah, blah, blah. United gave the impression they didn't really know what they were looking for. As recently as kind of late January, someone told me that they still hadn't decided what they wanted. And Ed Woodward, earlier this season, told someone it would take a couple of years for that appointment to be made, which strikes me as being too long. You should know who all the major players in that market are. You should know who the people are who you could appoint, who could do a good job. And to be honest, United should have an idea of what they want that job to be, because the one thing we don't know about Solskjaer at the moment, we don't have any proof of, is that he's good at recruiting. Because the recruitment he did at Cardiff, not great.
No.
The recruitment at Mulder is a different level. It's a different level of player you're looking at. you are basically going into a summer where you are already however many points behind your two fiercest rivals.
Well, there's a recruitment side in terms of identifying players, and then there's the delivery side, for lack of a better word, which is negotiating and bringing in players at the right price, paying the agents the right commissions, and being able to sell well. That's something that Woodward's done. Presumably he would continue doing that if there's no director of football. I don't think his record is as terrible as some suggest.
No.
But it's not great either.
But you're also looking at this, so this is the fourth time since Fergie left that you are effectively saying to a new manager, who do you want? And that's been then married with the board, in inverted commas, with Ed Woodward saying, right, well, actually, we want these guys, and well, they do. Whereas what United need to be looking at I hate telling football clubs what they should be doing, but it just seems sensible to me that they would be thinking, right, do you know what, we can't get into this situation again. We need someone who is overseeing this whole process, not just the signing of players. You can farm out the contractual stuff and what have you to Matt Judge, who does that already. You have people within the club who you can farm the actual writing of the contracts out to, as Arsenal having Huss Fahmy. But you need someone who is taking an overview, not just of the transfers, but the academy, the first team, the contractual status. Because they've not had that. They are basically the only major club without someone doing something similar to that. Except maybe Real Madrid, I guess.
Real Madrid's a bit different, but yeah, you have a guy who's a lot more involved, and Real Madrid's been a bit of a turnkey operation anyway the last couple of years.
No one looks at Real Madrid and thinks, do you know what, that is a great way, that's a great blueprint for running a club. And I just worry that the Solskjaer's success, it should have got him the job, but it should not have deprived somebody else of another job, because the two jobs are totally unrelated and United still can't seem to grasp that.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This season, with your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times, you can watch every highlight and every goal from every game in the Premier League. It's just £8 for an 8-week trial.
Now, let's move on to our second topic, VAR. I want to take you back to something which I believe you wrote or tweeted, which is that you made the point, and correct me if I'm misinterpreting this, part of the problem that you have, not with VAR per se, but with the basic notion that justice is a thing in football, that we should try to deliver justice by getting decisions right.
No, I think that's fine.
Good. So you agree with everything to do with VAR?
I think VAR...
Even offside.
I am pro-VAR, but I don't think it's the answer to the problem.
What is the problem?
The problem is fogginess within the rules, particularly within handball and offside, that I think the rules are wrong. I think we have lost sight, Gab, of the spirit of the laws. My least favourite thing is when people on Twitter, when you refer to the rules and they say, well, actually, they're the laws of the game, as though not knowing... But they are the rules of the game, with a lowercase r. That is what they are. They are the rules. They're not actual laws. They weren't written on tablets and given down from Mount Sinai. So is that the right mountain? I don't know.
It is, man.
Anyway, good. I think that we have lost sight of what those rules, certainly with offside, are meant to do. I think the handball rule has become unnecessarily complicated and really over sort of... Like just the language that we use to talk about offside is ridiculous. That making your body bigger and And we just sort of, oh, well, of course he was making his body bigger. What do you mean he was making his body bigger?
Handball, not offside, but yeah.
That's handball. So offside, I think we've lost the point.
Okay, but the reason all these things that you don't like have come in about the increasing volume, now we have the silhouette and stuff like
that. Oh, the silhouette.
Has to do with the fact that they said, look, we're going to remove more discretion from the referee and from the VAR because that is what gives us in trouble, right? We don't know whether Otamendi or Kimpembe meant to handle the ball. We do know they gained an advantage from their body position. So we're going to tell people, this is how you defend. There's a great example at the end of the Milan derby.
Danilo D'Ambrosio.
Absolute perfect. If you haven't seen this, the guy basically ties his arm behind his back and throws his whole body in front of the goal bound shot. No, he's saying, we're going to take this away, and these are the elements that you need to use to decide this. This happens in law all the time, right? You look at precedent, you look at situations, you look at what apply. You've got guidelines, and based on that, you decide whether you're going to go and punish somebody or not. I don't understand. The alternative is, oh, well, it has to be intentional. Hey, referee, do you think it was intentional? On what basis do you think it was intentional? Is it your mind-reading abilities?
That's all correct, Gab. I can't fault the logic. Although I would question whether the price that Dino D'Ambrosio paid was worth it. I don't know if it was. That all makes sense. The problem I have is that I think the week after the Kimpembe one, there was a handball, I don't know which game it was in, there was a handball that was very similar, not given, because you are still dealing with...
Was it in a Champions League game?
No, it was in a Premier League game.
Ah.
That, but you can't go, like that, because it's not ideal. The whole argument about... Or one of the whole arguments against VAR, which I stress, I am not against. I'm pro-VAR. I just think we have a problem with the way we approach the rules. Was that you can't have one way of playing the game differently in the Premier League, right, and a different way at Harrogate Town, in the Vanarama, whatever it's called. And that everyone sort of said, oh, we've got to keep the link between the grassroots and the Sunday lead and right, the Premier League. This is nonsense, total nonsense. But that was a powerful argument and one that UEFA adhered to for a long time.
Right, but that went away a long time ago.
You can't have separate rules in national leads and international competitions. Right. That is insane.
On this point, the directives, which is what we're talking about, the set of ideas to decide how to interpret this, they come from referees' associations. Now, obviously, this specific directive, if Mike Riley were here, we would ask him, like...
I think he's here in spirit.
He's here in spirit. No, he's one of the good guys. Certain other leagues went and they instructed them, we're going to interpret it this way. In Spain, you know, virtually every time the ball touches somebody's hand in the box, it's a penalty. In England, it wasn't. And in the past, we always sort of accepted that, oh, look, there's different things. Well, you know, that's a foul in La Liga. It's never a foul in the Premier League because real men and blah, blah, blah. But we are moving towards a game which is actually more similar. So this idea of different refereeing interpretations, this has always been, it's always been one of the things in football. I think with VAR coming into the Premier League, I think it's pretty inevitable that they're going to have to adopt the standard set by UEFA and by IFAB as well. And I think people are just going to have to defend differently. They don't all need to be Danilo D'Ambrosio, but...
Who's that brave?
You know, the Kimpembe one, I had a conversation with a former World Cup winning defender who's neither a fan of Paris Saint-Germain nor Manchester United. And he's like, yeah, he turns his head, but he's looking at him when the guy's shooting, so he knows he's about to shoot. And then he turns his head and he's turning his body and he throws his arm out. Like, there's absolutely no need to do that. And this is from his perspective. Yeah. And he did win the World Cup and the treble as well, actually. He also got somebody sent off in a World Cup final.
The Matrix.
The Matrix. But I think the point I'm making is once the rules are clear to everybody, then players adapt to them, right?
Yeah.
Like the back pass or whatever else.
Well, yeah, and this is why I'm not anti-VAR, is that there's certainly more than a kernel of truth in that as I think as it's rolled out across more leagues, that we will see more similarities in the way that the rules are applied, and that's good. Defending will change slightly, we'll see that kind of weird motion. I would argue that Kimpembe gains an advantage from his body being bigger, because as Tuchel said, that shot was going miles over. And I have...
But he doesn't know that.
No, he doesn't know that, that's true. But then that again brings in a degree of subjectivity, because the nature of gaining an advantage, how do you define gaining an advantage? Because you don't know what's going to happen. So, to me...
You make your body bigger, so you naturally gain an advantage.
Make your body bigger. This is a ridiculous phrase. It's a ridiculous phrase. He didn't throw his arm out. But more importantly, Gab, part of the reason that I get frustrated with the subject is because I think it's really reductive to focus on one incident. So yeah, the Kimpembe one was probably a penalty. To me, it was a bit borderline, right. But it's probably a penalty. It certainly wasn't the most outrageous decision you've ever seen. The problem I have with VAR is that I think it is highlighting the inconsistencies, both in which the rules are applied and the problems with the rules. And the people I blame for that are all of us.
Well, I don't blame us.
I blame you, I blame Charlie, I blame me.
You know who I would blame more?
The guy who invented the Moviola.
Well, you're right about that. There's a guy named Sassi, I believe, Carlo Sassi. For those who don't know, basically, this dates back to the early 70s in Italy, where every refereeing decision on the equivalent match of the day was slowed down to, and later on they had these 3D imaging and whatnot.
It was like an early forerunner of VAR and online technology.
Yeah, no, that's exactly what it was.
But with more shouting.
No, but what I would say, and if you use the collective we of the media...
I meant the whole world.
I blame, to some degree, when you watch a match with commentary, even if you're a referee, even if you're a natural contrarian, you're inevitably influenced by the first reaction of the co-commentator. And a lot of times, it's an ex-pro who, some of them are very good, some of them less so, almost never referees. Sometimes the referees come on in the little square.
And invariably say that the referees are right.
But there's been far too much of that recently. So it's a whole rubber stamp committee. But they set the tone, right? And inevitably, they're impacted by their own experiences when they played. I think that's one area where the media that deals with broadcast, because that sets the tone for everything, right? When we watch a match, we say, well, that was a foul, that wasn't a foul, that was never a foul, right? The first draft of history, so to speak, that is what influences us. And it's whatever that co-commentator says. Sometimes they say things which are completely absurd, and it sets the tone. And you know what? It sets the tone for the three dudes in the studio afterwards. We've all worked with these guys, and not that they're bad people, just that they're not referees. They often don't have the same independence of thought. And that then sets the narrative for the editor at the desk. And it's just like, well, but, you know, they were saying, like, are you sure that was a Rory? But what are you doing? You know, and that plants a seed of doubt. And then we end up in this circle of hell.
Newspapers and websites and magazines love controversy because it's a simple sort of binary issue. They love saying, you know, such and such was robbed, such and such was cheated. This was a terrible decision. Here's your villain. Here's your simple narrative. We allow the managers to get away with complaining about things that they shouldn't be complaining about. We've created this situation where we are convinced that referees are doing a terrible job. I think generally referees do a good job. Even the referees that I don't like, even the referees that when I see them, I think, oh my God, you are intensely irritating as a human being. I think generally referees do a good job, but we have created this environment where we've convinced ourselves we have to do as much as possible to get them to make the right decision every single time. And of course we should. We should encourage them to get the right decision. We should use technology to help them where it can. But we should also look at the rules and think, in certain instances, these are not helping. We should look at our reactions and think, do you know what, maybe this whole reaction, this twin demand for common sense and consistency, which are mutually exclusive, those two things you cannot have at the same time within refereeing. It's impossible, because there will be times when consistency is not common sense. We are asking too much of them. We're allowing VAR in particular to be subject to some sort of mission creep where it's sort of bleaching into more and more types of decisions. There will obviously be teething problems. I'm not anti-VAR. I think it's a good idea. I think we should give referees as much support as possible. But I think there's a more fundamental issue at stake. Yeah. I had another thing that annoyed me that I wanted to tell you about.
Well, maybe you'll remember it in a minute because Charlie's telling me we need to move on to supporters.
Get rid of them immediately.
When we talk about supporters, When I introduced this topic, I was struck by somebody who exposes at one extreme. He's a chief executive of a big European football club, former chief executive. And he said, football is still so far behind in getting money. There's, you know, the football system revenue is about $35 billion a year. And there are 3.5 billion people around the globe who self-identify as football fans. So we're making an average, you do the math, so we're making an average of $10. We can get so much more money out of them. I know, probably not a pleasant person, and you're breaking out in hives even as I describe this. But
is it Umberto Gandini?
No, it's not. But I was thinking about this, and just the idea of getting the balance between the match-going fans, who inevitably are going to be restricted geographically, to the fact that there's fans everywhere else. And who do you listen to? And how do people – and I'm interested in the concept of how do you become a fan, right? We're all stuck with this sort of very romantic notion, which is very true for a lot of us, that we support our local club or a club that we have a family member who was a supporter and it's been passed on to us. Now, that's not the case for you. You betrayed your local club, I believe.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
Leeds United.
Yeah.
Or maybe Harrogate Town.
Harrogate Town are flying at the moment. Yeah.
But this is the reality. The match-going fans can only be squeezed so much in terms of ticket prices and whatever else. And is there going to be a tipping point where clubs say, you know what, our constituency goes way beyond the people who go to the games. We make more money, and these guys contribute too. They contribute differently via subscriptions or whatever. They don't make noise on match there, or they might in their living room in Singapore. We don't hear it here at White Hart Lane. But how do you balance that? Is that a concern?
I think if I knew the answer to that, I'd be paid a lot more money than I am. I get really annoyed with the delineation of the good type of fan and the bad type of fan. The good type of fan being the match-going fan, the bad type of fan being anyone who's a foreigner, and people who only go once a year, or people who only go once a lifetime, or people who don't go at all, do they just stay at home and watch the games on TV? All of the money comes from fans. All right, the kind of ticket price thing, the amount you make at the gate is outmoded, and to be honest, that's a drop in the ocean for clubs now. But when we talk about TV rights and the booming Premier League TV rights, that's all coming because people are buying subscriptions. If people didn't buy subscriptions and then watch the adverts, those TV rights would not exist. The whole edifice is built on fans, on people wanting to watch. And I find it incredible that kind of anyone who goes to stadiums regularly will tell you that the worst people in stadiums are the kind of the fellas in their 50s who make no noise. Just, they just go into the game because that's what they've always done. They've got their ticket and they're paying a load of money for the privilege and they can do what they like. But they've got their ticket, they sit there, they grumble, they are convinced that there is a conspiracy against them. And they don't sing, they don't contribute to the atmosphere at all. For atmosphere, you want young people, effectively. Generally, that's, I don't want to slur the old, but you want the more young people you have in a stadium, the louder it will be, because they are likely to be A, noisier, and B, slightly drunker. I get really annoyed with the idea that if you're based abroad, that you're not a proper fan. If you're getting up at like 3 in the morning in Guangzhou to watch Tottenham or Arsenal or Watford or whatever, you're a fan. That is much more committed than the vast majority of fans in Britain are, that apart from the matchgoers. And to be honest, apart from the people who travel with their team, who are probably the most devoted of fans locally, if you're getting up at 2-3 in the morning, I've got my time zones right, to watch your team play football, that is devotion. But what interests me is, I don't know how many of those are monetizable. So you have your TV subscription, you might buy a couple, you know, might buy a shirt, you might buy a scarf, you might buy a bit of paraphernalia, some memorabilia. I remember when, a few years ago, there was I think El Globo, the Brazilian newspaper, did a study into which team had the most fans worldwide, which we all know the answer to.
It's always Flamengo.
Well,
when El Globo does it.
When British firms do it, it's Manchester United, 657 million
right.
People are Man United fans.
Followers, though. I think
followers.
Yeah.
So El Globo, whoever it was, did it, and the top three were Flamengo, Vasco and Corinthians. And they came to that conclusion, or maybe Club America in Mexico, they came to that conclusion, they specified, we have not included people in the Far East who claim to support Manchester United but never go to Manchester. You think, well, that's not really how supported and works anymore, is it, guys? You can't just fix it openly to be the answer you want. There will be lots of people in Singapore and in Malaysia and China and the States and Canada and wherever, and Australia, who are paying TV subscriptions which are contributing to the general wealth of football. I think there's probably a lot who don't, to be perfectly honest. I think there's probably a lot of people in the 3.5 billion who are football fans but don't have the money, essentially, to be monetized. So your chief executive's friend's dream of maximising that revenue is always going to hit a ceiling, because ultimately you could be a massive Man United fan from Indonesia and you're not going to have the money to contribute a vast amount to Manchester United's coffers or the football family's coffers.
I am interested in this concept, and I'm going to sort of bleed seamlessly into our fourth topic, which is the Super League, because this is an argument that goes back, and I want to expand it too. There was an excellent column in the game on Monday about how really the more than ever, it's the super clubs who run the game. you know, the way they're triangulating right now between UEFA and FIFA, the Club World Cup and whatever else. It's next to Colin by me, incidentally.
I was going to say,
yeah.
I'm waiting for you to mention that.
We're getting to the point where the imbalance of resources is just enormous. Do we just have to accept that this is a byproduct of globalization and figure out ways to mitigate it? Or are there ways to reverse it or to stop it?
You probably can't reverse it. I think the link is, you mentioned, how do we become fans? And increasingly, especially when you can detach yourself from the geography of a football team, if you're a kid in China or the States or wherever, you're obviously not grown up next to a club. You're not likely to have a family team that's passed down to you. You might, but you might not. And it certainly wouldn't necessarily be as strong as
you pick the teams that you watch on TV and that are successful.
That you watch on TV and that are successful, or that you play with on computer games, which is the main way that a lot of that's the gateway drug to football. So that then means support
coalesces. But you generally don't choose to play with Burnley because they're not good and they don't have anybody you've heard of. So you play with Manchester United.
Have you ever played FIFA with a professional footballer? It's hilarious. They will not. They're like children. So, are you a gamer, Dan? Have you played computer games?
No. I like reading books and bettering myself. I play the cello with Patrick Bamford,
the privately educated Patrick Bamford.
I guarantee you, Patrick Bamford does not game.
And
if you're listening, please set us right.
But I'm sure Patrick Bamford does. But if on the rare occasions that I've done it, when you're a kid, you always want to be the best team on a computer game. Right. You want to win. As you get older, you tend to go either for the one you support or maybe for one that you find interesting or whatever. But professional footballers will only play as the best teams. Literally every professional footballer plays FIFA as Barcelona. It's extraordinary because they want to win. That's their competitive spirit. They're kind of like children. But that's how kids are increasingly coming to football, which means support coalesces around the big teams, which means to an extent it is an inevitable side effect of globalisation, that the big teams get more supporters, therefore get a greater slice of the pie.
So you're saying a tiny bit like, remember Ian Ayre a few years ago, the former Liverpool chief executive?
How can I forget him?
Who, he made the point that the Premier League's overseas TV deal is split evenly between all the club, and that's a legacy of back in 1992 when, you know, their overseas rights, the value was about 50 quid, and so nobody cared.
You've also read The Club by Joshua Robinson.
Yeah, I also...
And the other guy.
Corny at the time, yeah. John Clegg. Clegg is very good. Stop it. But he makes the point, well, people don't tune in to watch Burnley. They tune in to watch us.
Yeah.
So I'm not picking on Burnley, but that is, I think, a tremendous example of a small club, tremendous history, but, you know, clearly doesn't have the fan base. And it becomes self-perpetuating. Mm-hmm. These guys in the Far East, they want to watch Liverpool. They don't want to watch Burnley. They become Liverpool fans. You agree that it's inevitable. What can be done to mitigate it?
I don't agree that a Super League is inevitable. I think it's inevitable that the big clubs become bigger and that there is a greater disparity of resources. And I don't think that's a good thing.
Well, sorry, you say Super League isn't inevitable, but we have Andrea Agnelli, the head of the European Clubs Association. There's his wet dream version of it, which, you know, I think there's been enough leaks about this, but it involves a Champions League that you don't actually qualify for, right? You get relegated out of. So if that scheme had been in place when Leicester City won the Premier League, they wouldn't have been in the Champions League. No, they would have been in Europa League 2 and with a chance to get promoted up into the Champions League 2 years down the line, by which point they would have sold Conte and Mahrez and everybody else and whatever. You would have groups of eight so they could play each other 14 times, and you would probably had an even steeper revenue allocation going to the bigger clubs. These are profit-making entities, right? And especially with financial fair play, there's the whole notion about, oh, look, football owners of football clubs are these patrons who lose money. No, they're not. Most of them make money. Most Premier League clubs make money. European clubs on aggregate made, I think, close to $500 million last season, whereas before financial fair play, they were losing close to $2 billion. So with that landscape, those guys have returns and they have investors and whatever else, and they're going to say, we contribute more to the pie, and it becomes almost a self-perpetuating circle, right?
Well, the interesting one is what happens when the Champions League is up for renegotiation in, I think, 2021, because UEFA have, to bring this properly around full circle, UEFA have said there are no more places going to be guaranteed for the the bid four or bid five leads.
2024.
It's 2024.
When that's, well, that's like because they extended the memorandum of understanding last month, which was due to expire in 2022. And they've extended it to 2024, which is interesting because that's also when the international match calendar comes up. And that is when everything could change.
Mm.
And, you know, that's when you could start having games on weekends, which obviously would have a wouldn't be welcomed by league football and many other people. That's when the whole scenario could change. That's when they could create. I mean, they did this in European basketball, right? When the big clubs started saying, well, yeah, we'll give you licenses to be in here, you know, 10-year licenses, which get renewed or whatever else. Until now, when you brought this up with like folks of the Premier League, they'd be like, oh, no, our clubs, you know, our Premier League is so lucrative. Premier League was a big bulwark against it, right? Mm-hmm. But Premier League, a lot of people don't quite notice that the last Premier League rights deal was less. For the first time, it actually went down. And I wonder if this is something we should be more aware of or maybe get more involved in.
I think the likelihood is, and I don't know, you'll know more about this than I do, the likelihood to me has always been that there would be some sort of version on continental Europe of a cross-border competition between the elite, with the Premier League standing apart for the first phase, because the Premier League is what the impetus for all of the continental European clubs is obviously, as you say, to maximise revenues, but it's also partly because of the gap to the Premier League. So I would still think the Premier League is a bulwark against it, not that the Premier League is a force for good or anything like that. The way to mitigate it, to me, initially, and it may not stop it in the long run, I would like to see smaller cross-border leagues given a chance to help.
I wrote that column like 10 years ago.
I know.
I was a visionary.
You were a visionary. I've written it as well, not maybe 10 years ago, but I would like to see, not the Atlantic League with a random selection of countries was a stupid idea, but I'd like to see it trialled.
Random, they're all on the Atlantic.
Is Norway?
No, the Atlantic League was Portugal, Scotland, Belgium and Holland.
Where's the Dutch border with the Atlantic?
It's water. It all you can. What do you think it is?
It's the channel.
It's just a different name. Still the Atlantic.
It's not the Atlantic. It's the channel and the North Sea.
It's not like it's a separate sea, Rory.
It's what? So the Pacific.
There's four oceans.
Yeah, the Pacific and the Atlantic are the same thing. So you could call it the
Pacific, Atlantic, Indian, and Antarctic. There are four oceans.
So you could call it the Indian Ocean.
You have to be in one of those. No, you can't because that's a different ocean. You have to go through the Atlantic to get to the Atlantic Ocean. Ergo, this is part of the Atlantic. Don't be silly.
The North Sea is part of the Atlantic. That doesn't make any sense to me.
That's like saying that, like, if you're in East Anglia, oh, you're not in England, you're in East Anglia. It's part of the Atlantic
Ocean.
But
if you're in East Anglia, you're not looking at the Atlantic, are you?
It's got nothing to do with the Atlantic. I'm using a geographic example. Anyway,
I think that was a strange idea. I'd like to see it trialled in Scandinavia, where I think they have tried it in women's football.
Yeah. Belgium and Holland had a league, which I think then they abandoned for women's league.
And
UEFA have lifted restrictions on this. They've set the precedent.
That, to me, is a way of just redressing the balance a little bit, given if you start it in countries where there would be no, in Scandinavia, there would be no fan problems in Holland and Belgium.
I had a suggestion for a Balkan league.
That would be
Greece, Turkey, Croatia, and Serbia. Yeah, boy.
That's a lot of derbies. I would like to see that given a chance, because I think if you combine those markets, you could potentially get Holland and Belgium together, could be a TV market worth roughly the same as, say, France. That gives them a chance to compete as well. I think that is the natural next phase.
And by the way, I always bring this back to basketball, because when the Super League discussion came up, when it was leaked by Der Spiegel as part of Football Leaks, you know, they had the list of the clubs in there. And for those who don't know, who aren't big basketball fans, back in 2000, that's exactly what happened. The big European club says, you know what? We're going to form our own competition instead of playing in what the equivalent of the Champions League, but it was called the European Cup back then. And they formed the EuroLeague, in which they're shareholders. The clubs are actual shareholders, and they have licenses, and there's requirements in terms of airports and stadiums and stuff like that. And it has been very successful. And the way a lot of clubs fought back against this was they created regional leagues. There is actually a league made up of former Yugoslavian countries. There's a league involving Russia, various Baltic republics, and I think Poland as well. They have tried that. And what happened in basketball was immediately you said, oh, you can't move outside the system. We'll ban you forever. We'll ban you from the Olympics and this and that. Yeah, okay. They tried to. So they said, no, you can't enroll in your domestic league. And then eventually they had to give up. Now, football's different. you know, FIFA is more powerful than FIBA was back then. The landscape is different. But that's the threat, isn't it? That is why we're all always going to keep inching in that direction.
I think it will be a slow process, partly because the first club to put their head above the parapet and say, we want this, we are pulling out of our domestic league, the reaction from fans pretty much everywhere, I think, would be one of splenetic fury. And I think
they're not going to say we'll pull out. We're going to play in our domestic league. We're going to pull out of the Champions League and we'll play in this new Super League that we created on midweeks. We still want to play the domestic league. And then it's up to the domestic league to kick them out.
Yeah.
Which is what, you know, FIFA and UEFA would then ask them to do it if the basketball model is followed. All I want to point out is that Barcelona, Bayern, and Real Madrid are members of EuroLeague basketball. And they're also, you know, three of the seven or eight super clubs that obviously run world football. So, or world club football.
So they have experience of doing this. Then they know what the
they've been
the
there. They've
is.
Done yeah. that. The blueprint is there. We need to wrap up, Rory.
I've really enjoyed this.
Thank you, thank you. I hope you'll consider coming back if we can up your fee. And it's funny because Rory came. Did you go upstairs and say hello to all your former colleagues?
No.
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 You're still persona non grata?
Yeah, they don't like me anymore.
Yeah, no, yeah. I didn't think so. Yeah, I saw you fiddling around, but you're obviously without a key card. You couldn't get into the lift. Anyway, thank you so much to Rory K. Smith. Obviously, you can go and read his excellent work in the New York Times. I have a subscription to the New York
That's
Times.
That's good to hear.
It's money well spent.
It really is.
Now, remember, you can subscribe to The Times, and you also get The Sunday Times, to enjoy award-winning journalism online or on your smartphone or tablet. I haven't made the joke that when I say tablet, I don't mean like those stone slabs, so I'll make that here. We don't mean, unfortunately, it's not available on the stone slabs, but it's more like your iPad, basically. £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Definitely money well spent. Search the Times subscription for more information. If you want to read the New York Times, feel free to use Rory's login, which is rorykksmith@gmail.com, and his password is Harrogate. We'll be back on Thursday with two of the top three meeting in Anfield, Liverpool versus Tottenham.
The game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.